Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with actor Kevin Early, who is co-starring in the production of Daddy Long Legs, which is currently playing at Florida Studio Theater. Kevin's not only a wonderful actor, he's a very interesting, thoughtful, and charming young man. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being your true self, your whole self, all of the things that you really are. It may seem ironic, but as a psychotherapist, I have observed over and over again that so many of us have been forced to leave significant parts of ourselves behind in our childhood. So many of us have been discouraged from being all that we really are. So many of us have been thwarted, subverted, made to deny really important pieces of ourselves so that we come into adulthood demonstrating what I call a cover story. You know, that's what spies call the tale they tell about who they are. It's a cover story, and it's designed to protect them. Because if the real truth were known about them, they would be in danger. Well, our cover story is very much the same. We decide in childhood, based on something that happens in our family of origin, something that happens in our community, something that we observe or happens to us in our school or with our peers or even in our religion, that something that is basic to us doesn't work. It brings a response or a consequence that we really don't want. And it seems to me that the job of childhood, in addition to learning how to use our hands and feet and mouth and talk and all of that stuff that we have to learn, the most important thing we have to do is not annoy anger, disappoint, upset, frighten. Those people on whom our well-being depends. Because basically, that's our parents, or our siblings, or aunt, or uncle, or grandma, or sometimes our neighbors. But this can also be true of, as I just said, the teachers in our school, or our peers in our school. It can be said of our community and what our community believes is right or wrong or good or bad. And maybe we don't fit it, or our religion. Maybe we have an impulse, an instinct, a way of being that just doesn't fit with some person, persons, organizations that we must fit with in order to be safe. And that's what it's all about. It's all about safety. If we annoy, upset, frighten our parents too badly, we know we're in danger. We know our lives depend on them being as happy with us as we can make them, or as happy in their lives as we can make them. Of course, we can't make our parents happy, but we all think as children that we must try. So, in the last analysis, if your family of origin, or your teacher, or your religion, or your siblings, or your peers didn't like something about the way you were, the fact that you like to sing or dance or tell jokes or laugh out loud, or you didn't like to eat certain kinds of food, or you weren't good at math, or you were dyslexic and couldn't read, or you wanted not to be that. You wanted not to have that. You wanted not to be someone who stood out for the wrong reasons. And children are amazingly flexible, and we learn very easily, very quickly, to pretend not to be whatever it is that's not working. And after a while, we get so good at pretending that we manage to keep the secret even from ourselves. And so we come to think of ourselves as somebody who doesn't laugh out loud, who likes to eat those things we don't like to eat, who doesn't like to sing or dance, who doesn't move when the music starts, or doesn't, you know. I interviewed actually a very prolific and to some people well-known writer who told me that he'd been writing since he could write. And he had written a story that... it was a fiction about some neighbors of his. He was 8 or 9 or 10 or something. And he made up a story about them, a story in which they didn't look so good. And he'd hidden it, but his mother had found it. And she commanded him not to write anymore. But somehow this young man didn't take that to heart. And he continued to write. But what he did do was he figured out how to hide those stories better. So if you're not someone who figured out how to hold on to that thing that was so important to you, just managed to keep it from the people who didn't like it, then what you probably did was stop doing it and come into adulthood pretending that you don't do that, that you aren't that, that you don't like that. And then you create a cover story. A story which says, I am all of these things, but not some of the things that you actually are. Now, what happens to those things that you first pretend you don't have and then forget you have? Well, they don't go away. They go undercover. They are hidden, not only from the rest of the world, but from you as well. Now, I believe that to go through life without access to all of who you are is a diminished life. I believe that when we have had to put important parts of ourselves undercover, while we have consciously forgotten that they are there, unconsciously we know that something is wrong. We're out of sync. We're not our whole selves. You know, there was a lot of talk for a long time about this thing about being a fraud. You know, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And well, I think that is a way of talking about how it feels when you have hidden important aspects of yourself. So as a therapist, so much of my work is about helping people discover whether they have in fact buried parts of themselves. In fact, people quite often come into therapy trying to be able to do something or stop doing something, thinking that they have to create a new something in themselves or a new person, when in fact they have already what they need undercover, but they've hidden it so far that they don't know it. And so the job of therapy is quite often to help the person recover. Now, I am, as I am clearly demonstrating here, an advocate for recovery. But I need to say, as a caution, we all have good reasons for hiding whatever we hide undercover. And when you start to try and recover, those good reasons that you had, they come back too. Which is why it's not so simple as to say, oh yes, I remember. I used to love to draw. I'm going to get that back. If you got criticism, neglect, abuse, teasing about your drawing, when you start to do it again, those memories will resurrect. And we quite often need help figuring our way through those terrible feelings. And of course, that's what psychotherapy is all about. So if anything I have said strikes a chord with you, if you suspect that you have hidden something you want back, if you are interested in psychotherapy and you want to talk to me about it, then you just have to go to my website, which is thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W, thelynnshow.com. You click on the little icon that says contact me, and you email me telling me whatever it is you want to say, and I will get back with you. Remembering or recognizing or understanding that I do all of my work on the telephone these days. So wherever you are in the country, you can reach me. Also on my website is an article called Psychotherapy on the Go, which will talk about what it's like to do telephone therapy. There's also the first chapter of my book. I'm reading it on the website, so you can listen to that and see what you think about it. And in addition to everything else, every single one of these shows is up on my website. All the podcasts of the shows and all the interviews that I've done, including the one that I'm going to play today with Kevin Early. Kevin, as I said in the lead-in to the show, is currently co-starring in Daddy Long Legs, an adorable, sweet, gentle musical, which if you haven't seen it, well, and Kevin will probably make you want to see it. He's charming. But you can take my word for it. It's really worth seeing, and it is continuing to play at Florida Studio Theater. So now, without further ado, here is Kevin Early. Okay, so I'm here with Kevin Early in a rehearsal space at Florida Studio Theater. Right, good. So I'm talking to Kevin because he is co-star of Daddy Long Legs, which is running at Florida Studio Theater now.
It is.
Yes. And I saw it, and you're quite wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Thanks for coming, and thanks for having me on your show.
You're very well. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's clear that you are currently making a living and maybe making a life with the art of acting.
I am, and I'm very lucky to do so.
Yes.
I think anybody who's in the arts and is able to, you know, do it full-time like I'm able to should count themselves very lucky. Because it's hard. Any of the arts are hard. It's, you know, a lot of self-motivation. And that can be, you know, that can be daunting day to day.
But when I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, I only ask one question.
Okay.
And it is, do you remember the very first time it occurred to you that performing, singing, dancing, having people look at you, telling stories, any of this was attractive to you, called you?
Yeah, sang out to you. Well, I have four older brothers, and a very talented mom who became an artistic director of a theater in Chicago. When I was probably 4 years old, and my brothers were all 2 years apart, so it was, you know, 4, 6, 8, and 12. My mom actually put us in a group called Mama's Boys, where we sang George M. Cohan music, like Harrigan and Yankee Doodle Dandy and stuff like that. And she made these striped, red, white, and blue striped outfits. It was very American. It was very American. And bowler hats and straw hats and canes and the whole deal. And she
four-part harmony?
I think we just sang unison. I think it was a unison kind of thing. But, and she threw us in a couple of little talent-y kind of contest things. And I have a picture of it, and I don't actually, like, remember it happening. But if I were to pinpoint, probably the first moment would be there was, and I don't know if Mom planned it, and she possibly could have, after the number was over, all the brothers would leave. But, of course, me being the littlest, I would end up staying on stage sort of looking nervous and being like, I don't know what's going on. And then my oldest brother, Tom, came out and dragged me off. Sure, there was a huge laugh, and that would probably be the pinpoint moment of when I thought, well, hey. You know? And what's funny is at that moment, I probably didn't have to do anything but sit there and be cute, you know, and realize that's entertainment. You know, that is what can get a crowd going. So that was probably, you know, that'd probably be the moment.
Okay, all right. So that's four, right?
That's about 4 years old.
Right, and in addition to the fact that you personally have a reaction from the audience that is separate from the reaction that you and your brothers get. You know, you get both. You get the reaction to what you and your brothers are doing.
Yeah.
And then you get this separate, special thing.
Sure.
That's just your own.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So if we assume that you're correct now and something inside of you says, ooh, that's nice,
mm-hmm.
like that. What would be the next time you did anything with that?
The next time I did something with that was when I was 10 years old. My mom had then, she started her own theater for a while, but they did a lot of older plays, like Last of the Red Hot Lovers and The Odd Couple. It was a group of her friends that did this for a community theater. And then she started in the box office at the Marriott Lincolnshire, and she became secretary to the producer. And during that time, they were having auditions for Sound of Music at the Marriott Lincolnshire Theater. And this would be a professional job. This wouldn't be, you know, community theater or, in, you know, in front of the high school. And I auditioned for Kurt, and after my mom having not told any of the production staff that I was her son, because she did not want them to hire me because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was down to two of us, and David Bell and Kevin Stites, and they were shocked to know that I was Diane Early's son. And they said, why didn't you say anything? She said, I didn't want you to be prejudiced or biased or, you know, towards my son. And they gave it to me. And so
okay,
was,
now wait a second. Wait. So between 4 and 10, did you take acting lessons? Did you take singing lessons? You just suddenly blossomed into someone who could do this?
I think so. No, I didn't take any voice, or it wasn't pushed upon me to do any of that. Obviously, I think when Mom did the community theater, we helped out painting sets and
but not on stage.
But not on stage, no. No.
And do you remember if you had any idea I might like to do this?
You know, I'm gonna take it back. Sort of. I think. I mean, there were things in elementary school that we would do little plays, little skits, little things like that. That
so
I was definitely involved.
Right,
I was definitely
right,
involved
right,
in.
Right. So you were already beginning to think of yourself in terms of this.
Yes,
I think so.
Yeah.
Do you know whose idea it was that you auditioned for Kurt?
It was mine. It was definitely mine because Mom was. She knew the business and she knew how hard it was, and she actually tried her hand at acting, and the sort of, you know, rejection of auditions was something that you either have or you don't.
You mean the capacity to tolerate it?
The capacity to be rejected from something and yet still say, you know, it's still what I'm going to do. Just because you don't want me, somebody else will.
Yes.
Or, you know, I will make my own, you know, I'll make my own way in this.
So she didn't have that, and
yeah.
She was worried for you.
So she was worried for all of us, all four boys. I mean, if any of us wanted to be in the business, you know.
Well, did some...
My brother Dave, I think, had a desire for it. But I think he sort of had the same gene that my mom had as far as the rejection goes.
Yeah.
You know, getting rejected once is hard, and sometimes that's all it takes. I mean, sometimes, you know, you end up doing all the plays in high school, you do all the, in college and... or wherever you're going, you do it all, and then you get in the real world, and you get a couple of rejections, and then that it just hurts too much.
Yeah.
It's just too. So.
Okay, so you're 10 years old, and you have your first professional gig.
I did.
My God, did you get an equity card?
I did not get an equity card at the time. They usually let kids do at least a few things before, you know, they let them get to 18, 19. And if you've done enough by then, okay, let's think about getting in the card. But because it was in Chicago and it was it wasn't Broadway or anything like that.
No, but Chicago's a very theater town.
Yeah, it's a very theater town. But not to get you tied down to that kind of a union at the age ripe age of 10.
Okay. So, do you remember the experience?
I do. I remember it to be just a blast and so much fun and. I remember falling in the pit one day and me and Friedrich are coming into the bedroom scene and I remember him cutting me off. Of course, I probably just slipped and fell. But I fell on the timpani and Joe, the drummer, just... Put me back on stage and crawled under the bed I remember my leg was sort of bleeding a little bit. Yes. It was just sort of scraped. It wasn't gushing or anything like that. But
Do you mean during performance?
During the performance.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was during the performance, and I didn't stop.
No, of course not.
Which relates to a story that just happened in September where I actually, and sorry for your fans, I had a sword go through my hand during a performance, and I didn't stop then either. So whether I'm falling on a timpani or having a sword go through my hand, I just keep going, apparently.
Right. You know, I believe I read in Shirley
MacLaine?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
In her autobiography, that she actually broke her ankle on stage and kept dancing. She didn't know she had.
Yeah, I would believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I would completely believe that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of, I've a lot of friends who've had something happen, and depending on where they are in the show and what's happening, like the timpani thing happened right before the bedroom scene, so I knew it was, I think I'd be fine, I'd be okay. The sword going through my hand actually happened at the top of Act 2 during Secondhand Lions, and there was really not much, I could stop the show, I guess, but I was like, I think I can deal with this, but after I went to the ER and, had, fluids flushed through it and stuff and did 3 more shows that weekend, it was hard, but it was like, hey, this is part of the whole thing. If you want to be involved and you want to be... certain injuries certainly have to stop the show, and certain, malfunctions have to stop the show, but I think at age 10, falling on the timpani was like, oh,
big deal.
I'm okay. The audience is okay,
right.
they realize it's live, and it does give one of those moments of, oh, hey, I'm not watching TV. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. This, I keep thinking of the song, another opening, another show.
Sure.
Your father died at dawn, but you go on.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's
to be a show business person.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. And there are certain things that most theaters will understand, and certainly the sword going through my hand was one of those. The stage manager was like, her finger was on the button to stop the show.
Right.
If it looked like I was going to pass out or not be able to sing. But I seemed okay.
And adrenaline.
Adrenaline is a wonderful thing, and that definitely kicked in, and I was definitely checking myself. Every once in a while, I'd be like, okay, am I here? Am I paying attention? Am I cognizant?
So you were singing clearly at 10.
Yes.
And you still are.
Yes.
So you hadn't studied then.
No.
What happens after 10?
After 10, I got lucky enough at 13 to get into another Marriott production, Shenandoah, and play the little boy in that. Same director, same musical director.
Yeah, they're happy to have you now because they know you, and they know they can do what they can do with you.
And one of the things that my mom taught me was that getting hired somewhere is not as important as getting hired back somewhere.
Yeah, right.
And having something on your resume that actually says you've you know, people hire you back is clearly an indication that you're nice to work with, you're talented.
You do the job.
You do the job. You show up 8 times a week. You know, because there's a lot more to theater acting than just showing up and doing it once. You know, you have to have the discipline of being able to show up, you know, for rehearsals on time, you know, do the show the same, you know, basic way every time in the direction, in the director and musical director and your vision and how the theater sees it and what their audiences will like and what they won't like. And
it's a challenge and it's a discipline. That's exactly right.
And it is something, as you said, you know, you have to learn. You know, I didn't really have voice lessons until I went to college.
Well, wait a minute. Okay, so you're 13.
Not to skip ahead. Not to skip ahead.
And then, that was cute. But now you're 13 and you have 2 professional, you know, performances under your belt.
Yeah.
Do you keep doing that, or?
After that, it would just be high school and high school performances.
Right. Have you decided now that this is what you want to do, or you don't know yet?
Not yet. I mean, it definitely is something I really love to do, and it's something that I think I have the capacity to have a, you know, sort of professional mind about, and certainly working with, you know, professional adults. Helped shape sort of how I saw that whole world, and having a mom in the business, you know, I'm sure helped. But it was definitely on the docket for something I love to do. Whether I thought I could make a living at it or not, I obviously was working with some people who were, and I would hear stories about how, you know, couples that were working at the theater were actually raising families in Chicago, you know, and this was specifically to Chicago because it is a very big theater town, and people were making a living, you know, and at 13 I could see that, you know, and I think that definitely had an influence. I think if you grow up in the financial world, or if you grow up in, you know, in a computer programming world. All my brothers, 2 of my brothers are computer programmers, which is what my dad was. One of them's an electrician, which my dad kind of worked with his hands a lot on cars and stuff. So it's not, you know, it's
so,
not too far.
So they all modeled your father and you modeled your mom.
Yeah, kind of. you know, I think you learn those things. You learn that you can make a living doing that. You know, I mean, I think, you know, Tom and Dave learned that you know, Dad was making a living at doing that. I learned that Mom was making a living, you know, in theater. And granted, she was, an artistic director, but, you know, it was still the same profession. I think at 13, I think I realized, oh, I could. But let's get through high school and see what happens, you know.
So you got through high school, and what happened?
Well, my road was slightly, you know, skewed because I had my mom was an artistic director, and I thought after high school, after doing like Curly in Oklahoma and the leading player in Pippin and Mercutio and Romeo and Juliet, then I was like, hey, high school's, you know, given me a career, you know?
Right.
High school doesn't pay though, so
right.
I got to get out into the real world. I went to a community college called College of Lake County for a number of years and tried to make it in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was realizing that I didn't have enough dance training, because I couldn't even get in the chorus. I could sing really loud, but I didn't really have any
nuance
skills.
Right.
I didn't, you know, and I could read music, sort of, you know, the notes go up, notes go down, that was about it. And I don't think my acting was, you know, probably up to par of what it needed to be in order to get on, you know, a professional stage. I did a few community theater things while I was there, and some stuff in the college. You know, I got my Associates of Arts there, but obviously I needed more training. This was not going to work out. I got 1 professional show. I did South Pacific. I did, you know, Lieutenant Quail. You know, I did, you know, and it was like, okay, this is something. If I want to do this, I have to go to school. So I applied to a couple of schools, and I got into Webster University in St. Louis Conservatory. Where I actually met my wife, Julianne Emery, and studied there. I took voice lessons, dance, jazz, ballet, you know, acting, Shakespeare, dialects, circus skills, directing, you know, I think going into it, you know, older, I basically transferred in, so I was, you know, with, you know, freshmen, you know, and sophomores, you know, when I was, should have been a senior, I guess. What was nice about it for me was I knew the skills that I needed. You know, I knew what I needed going in. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, you know, coming straight out of high school, if you want to do it, you're kind of like, mold me. Yeah, tell me what I need to know.
Right.
You know, which both work. I mean, everybody comes out of, you know, college, you know, sort of soaking up the knowledge. But I was like, I need to dance. I need jazz. I need a real good jazz class. I don't necessarily need the ballet, but that's the basics mm-hmm. of dance, so I have to take it. You know, I need to know my musical theater moves, you know, or musical theater dance, mm-hmm. you know, which is different, and they had some of those classes there, too. It was all the things that I tried to do on my own that I knew I didn't have the discipline for.
It's an interesting story because how I see it, anyway, is you clearly had something very young that said to people, you know, he'll be interesting on stage, he's interesting to watch, it's, you know, he can do this, right?
Sure.
So it happened for you very, very, very easily and very quickly. And quite often when that happens, and then you discover that it's not enough what you have naturally, people can't do what you did,
yeah.
which is start again, essentially.
Essentially, yeah.
You know, because the early success quite often, I don't know how to talk about this, confuses them, makes them think it's easy.
Sure,
you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, it came. Yeah, if it came easy to begin with, then why isn't it?
That's
why,
right.
Why isn't that status quo just, you know?
Continuing.
Why can't that carry me? You know, it's sort of the Mama Rose, you know, syndrome. I guess you could call it. I mean, I think she was probably talented as a little girl because she was entertaining. You know, it wasn't necessarily talent. It was just entertainment. You know, that she could entertain people with a story or with a song or with this. But to actually craft a character and craft a song, you know, and craft a scene, you know, that's a discipline. That's something you have to learn.
And you have to be willing to do it bad before you do it good. You have to be willing
yeah.
to accept the fact that you're not there yet.
Yeah.
Right? And that's that discipline. That's that thing, I think, that we were talking about, you were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah.
The ability to say, okay, it didn't work here, but I can work harder at it. I can continue to try for it.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I think, and clearly you had that. Clearly you had that.
I wanted it, you know?
Yeah,
and,
right.
And after not getting so many jobs and, you know, you either do one of two things. You either quit and just get another job and pick another profession, or you say, hey, I need more skills, because I don't think as an artist, I don't think you can ever sit back on your laurels and say, I'm done. You know, I am an artist now, and this is what I do. I mean, I think there are people who do that, but I don't. For me, that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to just be like, because as an artist, you already get put in a box from the public. You
yes.
know. I mean, if you're a painter and you paint,
portraits.
Modern portraits or modern or whatever you paint, you know, people are going to be like, oh, well, that's what you do. And then all of a sudden you bring this new piece out and they look at it and they go, well, that's not yours.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though they can't see how great it is or how good it is simply because it came from you. And as an actor, we sort of have the same thing. It's like I look like a leading man.
That's what typecasting is.
Yeah, it's exactly. I look like a leading man, but there are a few people who know that I can be funny,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that I have, you know, a little bit of timing with, you know, I'm a little goofy, and most of the casting directors, you know, kind of know that now, but at first it was always like, oh, he's an Ogeros, or he's a, you know, Curly in Oklahoma, is it this, you know, and they put you in a box, and that's where you're supposed to stay, and in order to expand that not only in yourself, but in order to get them to know that, you have to keep, you know, expanding your tools. Your tools, well, the tools that you have in your bag. My wife and I call it tools, you
mm-hmm.
know, and it's things that you can pull out to help you get, you know, a different role or to do something funny or you know, sometimes you'll get the opportunity to do it in an audition, and then hopefully you get, you know, an opportunity to do it on stage, and then, you know, people see it, and then they go, oh, wow, Kevin can be humorous.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But yeah, I knew I needed the skills, so, you know, Webster was a good fit.
And you were willing to do the work.
Oh, yeah. It was business. I mean, I hate school. I hate school. It's not something that I really like to do. I haven't, you know, had a voice teacher since I graduated from college. The college was the only, Gary Sims was my only voice teacher. That doesn't mean that I don't continue to work on my voice and work on songs and work on, you know, when I get an audition or when I get, I have to do a cabaret or I have to do in a show. I work on it. I work on it at home. I work on it with Julie sometimes. I work on it with the musical director. I just, as far as voice lessons go, I know my voice. I study my own voice. And I may not do everything correct. I may not do what one voice, because voice teachers are different. One might tell you, oh, you have to open up, or one might say, oh, no, you know, bring it back here, or this, and all that stuff's great. I don't knock that. And there are certain people who don't work on it themselves, so they need, you know, a voice teacher,
right.
Or they don't understand their own voice, and therefore they need somebody to say, this is happening, why is it happening?
Right.
I go, this is happening, oh, it's because I'm doing this. It's because I'm not opening up the vowel, or I'm closing off the vowel, or I'm, you know, it sounds too pop, it sounds too this, it sounds too that. So I work on it myself, which, you know, is same with the acting and same with the dance, you know.
You're always working.
Always working on it, you know. Yeah.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about Daddy Long Legs.
Daddy Long Legs came to me early on in its sort of conception. The Rubicon Theater up in northern Los Angeles. Anyway, the show sort of came to me early on. They actually asked me to do some of the early readings of it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when the production came up, and I didn't get to do any of the readings because I was always unavailable, which is very unfortunate because I really wanted to at the time. Right when they were doing the production at the Rubicon of this, and they finally got it all together, I ended up getting Millie, Thoroughly Modern Millie, on Broadway.
Oh.
So I ended up having to leave. So Megan McGinnis and Rob ended up doing the original production at the Rubicon, and they are the first right of refusal,
mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
Cast.
Right.
So anytime they do it, they get to say yes or no.
Right.
I got hired on later when they did a Detroit production that at the Gem Theater that Rob and Megan couldn't do, so they knew they needed sort of a second cast. And me and a girl named Christy Altamar were hired to do that production. And then we did that production, and I did another production with another girl, Effie Artema. And then this Penny McNamee is my third Jerusha.
Wow.
So what's interesting about this show, as far as packaging it goes, is the Rubicon basically has built two sets of the show, two costume, one for Rob and Megan, one for me and whoever. All the props are doubled. Everything's doubled, basically. They're kind of a double of everything.
In case of who comes?
Well, no, in case two productions need to be done at the same time. So what they're doing with different theaters, as they've done with Florida Studio here, is that they came to them probably four or five years ago originally, but they basically say, okay, we will come in 4 days before the opening night.
Mm-hmm.
We will tech in 2 days, and then we'll do like a run-through, and then we can basically open kind of on the third day, which is what happened here.
Oh, my God.
We did the lighting tech on Monday. We did Act 1 in the afternoon, Act 2 at night. Then we ran the show on Tuesday afternoon, we ran the show Tuesday night, we ran the show Wednesday afternoon, and we opened on Wednesday night. But what the Rubicon provides is all the rehearsal time.
Yeah, you're ready to go.
So we're ready to go. The theory, and theories are always, you know, meant to be broken. The theory is that because the actors know the show, the a lighting designer comes in and he knows the plot of the show. We do hire a local sound designer who will learn the show, and the stage manager who will learn the show. Sometimes we carry the musical director ourselves for this production. Corinne has been hired by the Florida studio. She'll learn the show. So that you save the theater on those 2 weeks of basically rehearsal.
Oh, and you save them on so much more.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have to build the set. They don't have to design the lighting. They don't have to...
They basically just rent it. You know, it's just a rental sort of package. Which, you know, there are theaters who will rent, you know, costumes, and they'll rent, you know, sets, and they'll rent all kinds of things, but they won't necessarily rent the actors, you know, or rent the lighting package and all.
Yeah, right.
So it's kind of unique in that sense. The chance that the theater takes is that they should go see a production of it, either with either cast, to make sure that their audiences will enjoy it.
Right.
And I think Florida Studio Theater really thought that their audiences would enjoy this, and we really haven't been to, a theater that hasn't, you know,
Oh, it's so delightful.
Yeah. And it's quality, I think.
Definitely.
Theaters, also, when you're bringing in a show like this, they want to know that the quality is going to be okay. Because that can really, you know, that can weigh on an artistic director or a producer's mind for bringing in a show, you know, like this. It'd be like bringing in a Forever Plaid with four guys you don't know.
You don't know, right.
And you're like, okay, how do I know
if they're good enough for
my audiences?
That's right.
Because you don't want to lose subscribers, you don't want to lose patrons, you know, over something that you didn't.
Yeah, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. The what you get is not worth it if you lose people over it.
If you're losing people,
right?
It's not worth it.
Well, in this case, I mean, I don't know who the other cast is. I'm sure they're quite wonderful.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. But you guys are great.
Thank you.
You guys are great.
Thank you, and I'm having a great time. But for this, because Penny was new to the piece, she actually was in New York, and she rehearsed for a week on her own. Mm-hmm. And then I came in the second week, and I rehearsed a week with her, and then we flew here for it. So it was kind of, what was crazy about the show originally when I did it, is I had to learn it in 3 days.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was because of a show I was doing off-Broadway called Death Takes a Holiday. I was standing by for Death, and he got sick 3 days before opening. And they called me and they said, you're going to be on Tuesday. And I went on Tuesday, and then I ended up going Wednesday, Thursday, and I ended up opening on Thursday night.
Oh, my.
And then I eventually ended up taking over the role.
Oh, my.
And at that point, I had already agreed to do this show, but the rehearsal was going to overlap with the final performances of Death Takes a Holiday. So I told the Rubicon, I said, I can't rehearse that show, this Daddy Long Legs, and perform Death Takes a Holiday at the same time. I said, so you're either going to have to replace me, or I said, if you want, I can come in Monday, rehearse Monday after we close on Sunday, rehearse Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, fly out Thursday, tech on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we opened on Tuesday. I said, if you want, I'm in.
Yeah, right.
I said, I know some of the music, and, you know, and they agreed.
Yeah.
So I basically learned Act 1 in 1 day, Act 2 in the first half of the second day, and ran it on that Tuesday night. And then I think we ran it again 2 times on Wednesday, and then we took off on Thursday.
So how many times have you done the show?
This is my 5th production.
Right. So you can do it. You can do it now.
Now I can do it. Right. Yeah. But learning it was, you know, was a bit of a challenge.
Well, it's a lot of music.
It's a lot of music, and luckily, you know, there's, you know, the letters to read, so I was definitely, definitely using those as a crutch for a while. Now I probably could do it, you know, without the letters, but I think, you know, reading the letters is part of...
Oh, no, it's nice.
You know,
It's nice. It looks,
if the letters
real.
It's interesting, I've always thought, what if the letters were just blank?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But then the audience, then that's just a trick.
No, and anyway...
That's just a...
It's different if you're reading it, and it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
exactly.
And why would you do that to an actor? I mean, it's unnecessary.
Well, why would you do that to an audience?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, the audience would then be like, oh, wow, they've memorized this whole thing, and that's all they would be thinking the whole
time. That's right.
As opposed to...
How bad would that be?
Yeah, I know.
Anyway. How long you're running?
We run to April 5th.
Good, okay.
Saturday.
Okay, well, if you haven't seen it, come out and see it. It's really wonderful, and he is really wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
You.
So, one last question.
Yes.
having given a life, and you really have since you started at 4, to this work of being a performer, an actor, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
It can be a struggle, but it can be amazingly rewarding if you put in the effort. I mean, if you put in the time and the effort to actually, be the best you can be, given the limitations of what you are. I mean, self-reflection and self-discipline are a major part of being an actor. I mean, as in any art. One of the other hard parts of being an actor is your life, is making sure that you pay your bills and take care of yourself and make sure you have a whole life that is relaxed and as, I want to say sane, but that's not the word I'm looking for, walking into an audition with desperation, walking into, on stage with desperation or with the baggage that you have during your day, is not healthy. It won't work either. A casting director or a director can spot desperation from a mile away.
Right.
And that's not what you want to be. If you want to be in this business, be in the business. It's a profession. Yeah, because one of the pieces of advice that if I'm talking to a class or talking to a group of young actors who want to do this is, I say pay your bills, first and foremost. You have to pay your bills. You have to become a person, an adult, a person who contributes to the society. Because not only does that, make you a relaxed human being and able to become an artist, but it also, it gives you a sense of self-worth, mm-hmm. rather than just be, struggling actor is such a term that I think was thrown around, 70s, 80s, 90s, that, I have to struggle for my art.
Right.
And it's like, no, you have to experience for your art. Struggling is an experience.
Right.
It's not the whole experience.
Right.
And
if you're not struggling, it doesn't mean you're not an artist.
No. It's taking a cruise
living.
Living, taking a trip, doing that, studying, theology, all that kind of stuff. That's studying your art. That's living. Struggling is one part of it. Certainly struggling can give you a drive for but also can being a waiter. If you're having to be a waiter, and there's nothing like, being a waiter to make you motivated to get an acting job if that's what you want to do.
Well, and you can learn a lot from being a waiter.
Yeah, you can. Mm-hmm. You can. But you have to be self-motivated. For a while, I was pretty lazy as far as an actor goes. I relied a little bit on my looks. I relied a little bit on this big voice that I had. Mm-hmm. And I sat back for a while on that, and that didn't work,
Yeah, it's what we were talking about before, about when things come quite easily to you.
Yeah.
That you do have to make a choice.
Yeah.
Am I going to go further? When it comes easily to you, quite often what people think is that I got this.
Sure, they become complacent.
Yeah, exactly.
With where they are. And certainly skills grow, over time just from the different things that you do. And there are certain people who, again, naturally can grow with that. And there are certain people that won't. And what's hard is the self-evaluation of that, is to actually honestly look at yourself and say, okay, why am I not working if you're not?
Right.
It's not just, what a lot of people see on stage. They're just like, oh my God, they're having so much fun. And you're like, well, that fun took a lot of work. And it takes a lot of work to relax enough to have fun.
Even while you're having fun, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's work to do what you do.
Yeah, you're still constantly, even in this show, I'm constantly evaluating what I'm doing as it goes, and evaluating the audience, and evaluating, you know, my performance, and trying to make it better, and evaluating my relationship with my other actors on stage, and just trying to craft it to be the best it can be that show. Yeah, and then the next show is another challenge.
Yeah, it's about, I think what I hear you saying anyway is that it's about the capacity, the willingness to do self-reflection, and then, depending on what you have reflected, do what is necessary to be who you want to be. Is
yeah.
that close?
Yeah, I think that's close. Being genuinely yourself.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin.
No, thank you.
You're very welcome. And I don't know, maybe I'll get a chance to see it again.
Maybe. And I hope you get to come back down to Florida Studio Theater. It'd be nice.
We would like to have you back.
All right.
Being genuinely yourself. Easier said than done a lot of the time. And for Kevin, who was so lucky to have a family environment that not only recognized and accepted, you know, what he was, who he was naturally, but encouraged him, supported him, enjoyed him. It's all there is, really, to make it possible for us to be who we really are. And unfortunately, not everybody gets that in their early childhood. Imagine that at 4, he was exposed to this experience which said to him, "Ooh, yes, I like this and I can do this." And from then on, it was always okay with him, okay for him to explore those feelings, those experiences, and to pursue them. So, did you have that in your childhood? Did you have a family environment where whatever you did naturally, whatever spontaneously came from you, was not only accepted, but enjoyed and encouraged? No, lots of us didn't. Lots of people had parents for whom that didn't happen. You know, if your parents had a childhood in which they were not completely accepted as who they were, then they didn't have it to give. And whether they loved you or not, or wanted the best for you or not, they couldn't give you what they didn't get. That is quite often, unfortunately, the case. It's not from malice or cruelty, but from the inability to give what they didn't get. So if you didn't get it, if you are aware that when you see somebody up on the stage, you know, telling jokes, and you think, and you know that you are basically a pretty funny person, and that in your life people seem to laugh at you, and people are always saying to you, "God, you ought to do stand-up," and there's a part of you that really wants to do stand-up, right, but you can't even imagine it. Why couldn't you imagine it? Well, can you imagine that something was said or done to you at some point in your early life that suggested to you that that was a no-no, that you oughtn't to, shouldn't, that you were embarrassed or teased or told that that was not, I don't know, didn't fit with the image that your family wanted you to have? Or were you a little girl who wanted to play with cars? Or were you a little boy who wanted to play with dolls? You know, were you somebody that your family thought you shouldn't be? This is not the way little boys or little girls behave. And your parents were shocked or upset by that. I like to tell this story, so if you've been listening to my show, you've probably heard it before, of a client of mine whose mother took her to a another child's birthday party. She was maybe 5 years old. And at this birthday party, the mother of the birthday child had cleverly bought presents for all of the children. All of the presents were in the middle of the room, and the children were all given numbers, and they were allowed to come up by number and pick the present that they wanted. And this little girl got number one. She went running up and picked up the biggest present in the of the lot, and immediately her mother said, "Put that down. You don't pick the biggest present." And some, I don't know, 40 years later, when she sat in my office, she could still blush with shame at remembering that chastisement. And so she did not go for what she wanted in the rest of her life. If she wanted it enough, her brain dropped a chemical in her bloodstream that said, "Don't go there." And she didn't go there. And I don't have to describe the many ways in which not being able to go for what you want can affect a life. So do you have that? When you really want something, do you feel that it is somehow shameful or dangerous, embarrassing to say, "I want that"? Do you use the words "I want"? Lots of people can't, you know. Or maybe there's some other thing that you wanted or tried or were drawn to, and you can even sometimes imagine it now, but you can't actually imagine doing it or going for it. It's not too late. So, this is the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. You listen to Kevin, and it's all over the place. His commitment to being who he is and putting up with going to school, which he hates, and continuing to focus on being better and better and better, because this is what he wants. This is who he is. He's not ashamed of it. He's not embarrassed by it. He's in it. So if this is inspiring to you, which I hope it is, remember that you can reach me at my website, thelinshow.com, and please do. Just remember not to leave the E out of Lin. Well, all right. As always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that, as I said, inspired you, or something you learned that you didn't know, or something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten